have to admit I didn't look at anything tonight. So we do have, Baruch Hashem, a very wide array of people. So what we're going to do this evening, I'll explain what I intend to do. Everyone here is a learned crowd. It could be that it's too basic for all of you. If it's too basic, I apologize, and I'll shift to something else. But that's what I prepared. One of the things we didn't talk about was the level of preparation. So basic preparation. So what I intended to do is really the following. And then if people like, we can always do some things a little more exciting. What I wanted to do is really, when we talk about the preparation of preparing for Pesach, so we are blessed with a plethora of options. In fact, you can even take out the Jewish action right there, and I printed it out to you to see. You should really take a look at it. We'll get there in a moment. A lovely example of the modern kosher kitchen, and all the halachos pertaining to how you deal with each of your utensils in your kitchen. You want to see it? I'll get you one. I'll get you a bed.
Okay.
The magazine. In the middle of the magazine. Middle of the magazine.
I didn't have a chance to go to
it. Right. So or you could go to the CRC website, and it's wonderful. Everything is there. So what do you need me to do? So what I'd like to do is the following. I want to get to the basic concepts in terms of the nature of our prohibitions of chametz. What are the nature of the issues? What are the issues involved? And really get to the overarching concepts that lead to our discussion of what to do. And again, for some people, I'm sorry if it's ready too easy, too obvious, my apologies. And if you'd like, I'll throw in something else a little interesting. We'll talk about interesting minhagim that we have. The fact that my family uses bananas for karpas, we really do. It's a great thing.
Really?
I'll explain that. We'll get there. But that wasn't the issue. So what I really wanted to do is really talk about...
Right?
I'm sorry?
No.
There is an anecdote that I'm fond of recalling where I was talking about my son's... So let me branch up. My intention is to talk about chametz. That's what I really wanted to talk about. But since I already made reference to it, might as well give it due duty. My family, the luck is in terms of karpas. What do most people around the table use? Karpas, what do you use?
Potatoes.
No,
potatoes.
What do you use?
Vegetables. I could say I don't know.
I know, but what do you actually use? You vary it every year?
So we put out crudités.
Okay.
Well,
potatoes.
So my family always used parsley, but I hate parsley. So I actually moved to bananas also.
Wow.
Person.
Potatoes.
Potatoes and eggs.
Celery.
And you know, celery.
Potatoes, carrots, and celery.
Okay. So my family uses bananas. And why do we use bananas? So my late great grandfather felt that it was definitely a situation where people would not be aware that that was the proper bracha. Many people think with the way bananas grow that they should be like fruits, the clan should be in the eights, but it's not, it's the hadama. So my grandfather figured, what better way to teach his children that it's really hadama than by using it for karpas? And moreover, anytime we have any guests at the Seder, it definitely raises, like, really? You just put out a banana? Like, where's that for? That's not on the Seder plate. What is it doing? But the story that Ilana is referring to, the story I've told, about my son Mordechai and his dedication to his Rebbe. Because we moved to Cleveland, and he is in Mora Eli's class. He's in Mora Eli's class, and obviously they prepare for the Seder like you should in Mora Eli's class, and he comes to our Seder, and we put out the bananas because that's our minhag, and he says, that's not what Mora Eli said. So he was not going to eat from something that deviated from his Rebbe. It goes to our discussion before, right? So he was very adamant that Mora Eli had said something different, so he held off for his parsley or his potatoes. So in that year, we were able to do both. Of course, he also that year was insistent. He learned about the Korach sandwich, and for him, a sandwich had, I think, what did he like in his sandwich? I think he was liking cream cheese. So he was very, he wanted to know when he was having his cream cheese and his Korach sandwich, because he was having his sandwich. What I want to focus on really is the nature of chametz and the nature of the preparation. That was the point of our learning this evening. So I want to focus on there. So I do want to mention just one parenthetic comment that I was told, and I haven't seen yet in print, that Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, who was our wonderful guest last Wednesday night, put out on his blog post that if he spent more than a day cleaning for Pesach,
it's spring cleaning.
Why are we cleaning it off? Why are we working so hard? What are we doing? What's the issue? So the truth is, there are a number of things that the Torah describes. The Torah does not anywhere describe the needs for us to clean for Pesach. It doesn't say that. What does it say? So the Noah's prohibition, the Torah does talk about not eating chametz. That's the obvious one. Well, if it's not eating chametz, so then if I don't have to eat chametz, I have a lot of yisurim that I'm not allowed to eat. Doesn't mean I can't have it in my house. Doesn't mean I have to spend extensive time cleaning. But that's one thing. So we know the Torah does prohibit clearly eating chametz. Additionally, the Torah does have a positive requirement to destroy chametz, mitzvah of tashbisu. What form that takes? Is it actually burning of chametz, getting chametz? Otherwise, that's clearly in the Torah itself. We also have something else. We also have the concept of ba'yira u'ba'yimatzeh. So what does that mean? Translated literally, that means you shouldn't see it, you shouldn't find it. What does it really mean? So that really refers to not seeing it, because no one's going to claim that if I walk by a bakery, I should be zealot and burn it down, right? You don't say you can't see chametz. What does it really mean? What does it mean?
Can't see it in your
property. That I can't have my possession. It really means that I can't have the ownership. We won't get into the whole elaborate kind of discussion as to what degree we say the chametz really is not mine, because it's asur bahanam, I'll have better from it, but the Torah makes it as if it's mine. The bottom line is, I really shouldn't be having any chametz in my possession, and it's really my chametz that I shouldn't see, not having any chametz at all. Okay, none of it gets to my checking. So because now, if I know that I don't want to violate all these prohibitions, I don't have a prohibition of eating the chametz, I don't have the prohibition of, I have this requirement to destroy the chametz, and I have this prohibition of bayira bayimatzeh, so that has what it has developed the idea that I have to go and search for the chametz. So what is that obligation? So that's really a din d'rabbanan, and we say the din d'rabbanan is to do bedika, to check. Now again, when does that chiyuv kick in? What is the nature of that obligation? The nature of that obligation is, it actually, it's a little misnomer, people don't realize, it kicks in, shloshim yom kodem achag, 30 days before the chag, which means it already kicked in for all of us. I know you go away on vacation. I know you're going to go away, you're selling your house, you're not doing anything. So we'll discuss that in a moment, because that's not really what the Torah or Chazal had in mind. I know I feel like a bad YouTube video. Tati, is that what they did to Mitzrayim? There's a very funny YouTube video where they talk about where they have these yeshiva guys who had way too much time on their hands, and they made a very, very funny video. And they ask, like, and one of the characters goes, you know, what Kalamoy trips did they go on when they were in Mitzrayim? I don't think they went on any Kalamoy trips. So there's a concept that 30 days prior to Pesach, the obligation to do the bedika already kicks in, and I have obligation to check. So I have obligation to check my house and make sure that I'm in there. And that reason for the bedika is, of course, to prevent all the problems that we just enumerated. I want to come to a situation where I'm going to be over these various yisurim. So the way to solve that problem is to check, do my cleaning. Again, whether it's a one-day cleaning or a spring cleaning is a personal personal choice, so to speak. We sometimes mix the two together. Of course, those of us who are blessed with small children, I'm not quite in that same category anymore, know that no matter how much cleaning you're going to do, you're never going to be totally successful. I have recounted a story in the past. I apologize for repeating myself. A good friend of mine recounts that one time in the middle of their Seder, their youngest sibling came out with a cookie. With a cookie. And they were perplexed. They could not understand. They had searched the house so carefully. Where could that cookie possibly have been? And they tried to cajole the little boy to reveal the source, and he refused. No cajoling worked successfully. Okay, they figured he must have hidden one cookie. Who knows? Next night of the Seder, same time of the Seder, he's back with another cookie. Clearly, he had hidden more than one. He had hidden a stash. So those of us who are blessed around the room with younger children, you should be both. You should do as much as you can, or you should give up. It's never going to help. But so we do have this concept that 30 days before the Chag, the requirement to the Bedika has kicked in, and therefore I have to make sure I move on my chametz. What about this concept that I should just sell my house? Does selling my house absolve me of this halacha? So what's that concept? You will not find the discussion of mechiras chametz even in the Gemara. That's it's a much more modern is a relative term. Modern in the scope of Jewish history is a modern term. So why do people sell chametz? So let's leave aside what we do in a modern age. What happened historically? Well, historically, what happened was there were Jews who were involved in, well, we haven't even defined what chametz is yet. We'll get there in a moment. We have to define what chametz is. But there were Jews who were involved in various forms of commerce, and the forms of commerce they were involved in required possession and owner of real chametz. If they were going to use it up, it's one thing for us to calculate, okay, I have X amount of days left, I have Y amount of cereal, and if I calculate the formula properly, I could use up all the cereal and be done with all my chametz before Pesach. That's relatively easy. By contrast, we're talking about individuals who, I own a brewery, or I own a bakery, and I'm going to get rid of all my chametz, and then reopen after Pesach, I'm done. So they created this concept of mechiras chametz. You can actually sell your chametz. And the idea was not for us to go, and again, this is not chas v'shalom a critique of anyone who is doing this, but it's not for us to go to Florida and sell all our chametz and not do any charge of cleaning for your home at all. The idea of mechiras chametz was I'm doing all the regular checking, of course, in my home, but since I'm possession of it's going to be an incredible financial hardship, so therefore I'm allowed to sell my chametz. Now, selling the chametz has to be done very carefully, very properly. You will find that there's a whole different question when I sell a chametz. I'm obviously selling it to a non-Jew, and the first criteria, of course, is determining the person really is indeed not Jewish. I know, there are chuckles among the group, but they say, and I don't know if these are one of these apocryphal stories, that the person they were selling all of Yerushalayim was selling their chametz to someone who turned out to be Jewish for all the years. I don't know if that was true or not true. They're all these apocryphal legends. You're not sure they're true because they say them about two different people, and you probably think it's not true. It probably didn't really happen to both. But they say a similar story about Rav Moshe. But, all right, I don't know. We sell it to Earl MacDonald III. He's a wonderful gentleman, lovely African-American gentleman. I don't think he's Jewish. I really don't think he's Jewish. We've had this discussion, Earl and I. He has a beautiful soul, but I don't think he's Jewish. And I think we're really fine. You also have to make sure, though, that you're really doing the mechira in a manner that's really halakhically appropriate, that really is correct, that really is, and if anyone wants to watch and see the mechiras chametz, we do a series of different forms of acquisitions to make sure it's really done properly, all different types of halakhic kinyanim to really make sure the transaction is a legit one. Moreover, we have to be sure the transaction is going to take effect, so he's going to make, how does he pay? The Baruch Hashem, I have the ability to now this year, I sell, various people come to me, so the chametz in your home probably is not worth that much. By contrast, there are certain individuals who own nursing homes and they sell me their chametz. Well, that's a lot of money. I'm sure Earl makes a stellar salary cleaning all the shuls in the block. I'm sure that's puts him in the 1%, being a little facetious. I don't think that it does. So how is he paying for that? So the luck is, of course, he makes a down payment. And then with the agreement that we'll come to terms afterwards, and the terms will be, and we'll be able to determine how much it will be based on evaluation of experts to come. But it really is a sale. And in fact, if he chooses at the end if he can come up with the money, we can figure it out. The chametz really does belong to him. It really does. It gets very complex. I won't get into it. It's a little beyond the scope I'm going to cover this evening. My late grandfather used to sell supermarkets, and how you sell the supermarkets and how they deal with the profits in between, how that's all figured in, is a very big shaila halacha. Not everyone agrees you can do that. And it gets much, much more complex than that. Because even when you deal with all the supermarkets, what we're not aware of is, I'm sure Boris knows this quite well, so when you're buying from the supermarket, how many of these supermarket chains have warehouses of their own? They're all getting from various distributors who are getting from someone else. Well, I'm making sure that the supermarket's selling their chametz, but what about the step before? What about the distributor? Who's making sure of that? So fortunately enough, I can show you an article, a wonderful article, and you'll read all the names of these distributors, and you'll say, oh my goodness, they're like 80% Jewish. CNS stands for Cohen & Siegel. Like all of them, it's unbelievable how many of them are really Jewish. So you think you're really dealing with it on the back end, dealing with the supermarket, you really have to deal with all the rest. So the truth is my grandfather used to take care of all of this, and my uncle takes care of a lot of them as well. But it's a very interesting issue, and that's real chametz gemer. You'll find in exchange that there are many individuals who actually try very hard in their privacy of their own homes, not to sell any chametz gemer. You ask them, why do you do the mechira at all? So there are interesting categories in between, which we'll address in a moment. There are some in-between categories where maybe it's chametz, maybe it doesn't have the halachic status of chametz, and therefore I'll sell that. I know personally, I try, if my wife and I can manage it well enough, to get rid of all the real chametz in the house, to try not to sell any real chametz if we can avoid it. We've been less successful as we have more children. But if you can do that, there isn't a certain something to that, because the mechir was designed to obviate a certain problem of a very severe nature. It was not designed for us to not do the mitzvah whatsoever. Again, not a judgment at all. You know, but one person has to do a certain level of bedikah, one has to do a certain level of checking.
How do we officially define chametz gemer versus something?
So I'm going to get there in a minute.
There's a chart in here. The different foods, but
right. Part of the challenge preparing tonight's shiur was you could just, I could just give out the booklet. There really isn't that much else to do. But that's why I'm trying to give more of the underpinnings. That was really my objective tonight. So there really are four terms that we often sort of link together, but there are four different terms. There's the bedikas chametz, which is the search. There's the bitul chametz, which is what we call the nullification, right, which we do twice. We do it both the night before and the following day. We have the bir chametz, which is the burning of the chametz. That is the time that every young child gets to be a good pyromaniac. That and, of course, Lag BaOmer in Israel, where the whole nation becomes pyromaniacs. note to yourself, if you've made Aliyah or you're in Israel for Lag BaOmer, close your trees, close the shades for weeks before and weeks after, because the smell of smoke is very pervasive, because every few blocks there's another bonfire. It's a very big idea in Israel. Little kid, you can find it. I remember we were living in Mevaseret, and there on the hill you had the fourth grade boy, the fourth grade girl, the fifth grade boy, the fifth grade girls. Everyone had their own bonfire, of course. So yes, but that's the bir chametz, the getting rid of the chametz, the mitzvah of actually getting rid of it. And there is such a mitzvah, whether or not it's actually destroying it by burning it or something else is a machlokas, but we tried therefore to burn it. Please come and join the Boy Scouts. No royalties for Greenheart Synagogue, the Boy Scouts here, Erev Pesach. And then there's the mechiras chametz, the sale of the chametz itself, which are the various means of, and we try to do all of them. And by doing all of them, we found a way to make sure that we are covered in all these areas. So Michael asked me, well, what is chametz? So how would you define chametz? Who wants to define it? Who wants to take a chance? What does it mean? There's no trick question. I know all the people here already know the answer. They're thinking Rabbi Blau has a trick question, and they give the answer, it's going
to
be...
It has to be made of the chametz mini dagan, but the question is, when is it considered to make sure?
So we do say it. It's a food item that comes from the various five grains, and it's food that has been leavened, we say. What does that mean? So Eric could probably explain this better. A fermented grain product, right? What is that?
Typically, you mix something with, if you mix any of these five flours with water, there is, in the air, there is yeast spores. So we would normally call it a sourdough, like a San Francisco sourdough. So it's almost impossible to mix anything in your kitchen and not have a couple of spores of yeast come on in and start the leavening process.
Okay, so that's what we call chametz gamar.
Scientific answer.
Well, I go to Aaron because he's my most knowledgeable scientist and also who blends the Torah matter well. It also has to be something that's edible, even if it's only edible by your canine animal, by a dog. We call that roi l'achilas kelav. And I know, there's so many interesting stories of roi l'achilas kelav. What does it mean? It doesn't mean some of these stories are nice and legendary and may or may not have really happened, where we talk about toothpaste, and toothpaste isn't roi l'achilas kelav, and someone raised their hand in Rav Soloveitchik shiur or some other Rosh Hashiva shiur, depending on who's telling the story, and he said, but my dog eats toothpaste. And which he legendly said, what do I care about your dog? What about you? You know, so you have a crazy dog. What does that mean? That doesn't mean that's the genetic. So it's not a category of one's personal canine, personal pets. It's more a general category. Is it Roi L'Achila? The Roi L'Achila is, though it's very significant, it's not Roi L'Achila only for Bnei Adam, but even Roi L'Achila for an animal, it's still Roi L'Achila. It's still considered edible, and that would still be problematic. There's something interesting. In order to violate the Isser by Rabbi Matzi, how large must it be? So there's a distinction here between the halach of the prohibition of eating chametz. Chametz is asher, we famously say, b'mashru. Even a minute amount of chametz is going to be prohibited. Even the most smallest amount of chametz is prohibited. That is not prohibition in terms of the seeing it, the owning it, the possessing it. That's really true. Back to our cookie story. The prohibition in terms of achilas chametz is, no, it's reversed, I'm sorry, achilas asher b'mashru. The eating is eating with a smaller amount. Normally we say in order to violate by Rabbi Yamatzeh, you have to have the shear of a kazayas, which is an olive, which is really the condensed amount being an olive, not an olive per se, that's the halacha. So what is interesting is you do have things like grain alcohol. So grain alcohol is a fermentation product. So usually we say it's chametz. The question is it mixed up with something else, is it still edible or not edible? So how many people try to get rid of all their, like, we used to try to get rid of products that are not, you never eat them by themselves, but can I take out the alcohol component and I could drink the alcohol by itself?
Like
not perfume?
Drink
the alcohol, like perfume and the like. Who's so machmir to get rid of all your perfumes? No such gomra, right? Should we make it up?
I mean, they used to exist.
What?
Is Rob Blumenkrantz machmir on that?
He may be. Could be. I think he is. Ah! There you have it.
They grew up with that book.
What?
Everybody grew up with that book. So.
Right. So Baruch Hashem, there are many more books. let me explain that comment. You have to give credit to the individual who's pioneered it. Rabbi Blumenkrantz was one of the pioneers to put out these Pesach booklets, and he had a lot of things, a lot of information in his Pesach booklets. Now, again, Baruch Hashem, you can get it on the OU, the CRC, the Star K. Some you have to pay for, some you don't have to pay for, but you have a lot of information about all the various products. He was one of the first ones to do so. The only challenge was that he was presenting his view. It wasn't necessarily the halachic view accepted by the broad swath of Rabbanim, and he was very machmir. So many, many people grow up with that was their source of much information, and the book had a lot of other things in it, if you recall.
Shampoos.
No, I mean a lot of other things that weren't doing with kashrus, didn't do with even, you know, that was a good forum. Rabbi Blumenkrantz wisely realized, everyone has to buy my book. So all the other things that I really care about, he used to put in the book that have nothing to do with Pesach.
It's a thick book.
What? It was a very thick book.
And it also changed every year.
Right. Yeah. So it's got to be interesting, because the Hilchos Pesach for the, how is it the Hilchos Pesach for the Star K is this big, and the Hilchos Pesach for Rabbi Blumenkrantz is this big. The halacha shouldn't be that different, and the amount of medicine shouldn't be that different, but that was really his way of doing other things. So he was much more machmir. We have to be worried about taking out, extracting the alcohol from a larger product, which is really not Roy L'Achila at all, so I have to worry about that as well. Some people do, some people don't, most people don't. He would accordingly. There are unique other things that we have to think about. So, for example, any Svardim amongst us? Any want to be Svardim amongst us? So why do I bring that up? Because one of the things we think about in terms of our preparation for Pesach is the question of
kidneys.
I think over my 30 years in the rabbinate, the two requests I have most often from people, from Balabatim, is, Rabbi, can you abolish kidney oat? And, like, I have the authority to do this.
Can you get rid of second amputees?
Correct. Yes.
You're the one who asks him.
I think it's actually fascinating. Sometimes you have these mock lists of things that people are really concerned about. I once saw a mock list of tfilos that never get said, which we won't get mentioned, which tfilos are somehow don't get do well. Second, the Yantav gets a very bad rap. I will definitely tell you, and I can't speak for the, because I don't do as much of the preparation, but I always enjoy the second Seder much more than the first. The first one is so rushed, and you're so exhausted and everything else. And after the first day of Yantav, perhaps those people who are working hard at preparing for the Seder don't share that degree of, maybe that's a male-female thing. Is that correct?
I would say that's pretty fair.
you're not really preparing anyhow before.
Yeah, I just think the stress of the second Seder for the gentleman who's only participating in it is not quite the same for the woman who's actually preparing it. Is that a fair assessment to this side of the room?
I mean, carrying a bunch of chairs to the table is not
Hachana? Maybe halachic hachana, but I'm not sure it's hachana in the sense that we need it. Nonetheless, so kidneyos is a very interesting idea. So what is the meaning of kidneyos? Why do we not eat kidneyos? What are kidneyos? Anyone wants to take that one? What are kidneys?
Rice legumes.
Right. So why are they aser b'achila?
They might resemble flour.
They might resemble flour. What's also the issue was the resemblance themselves. Also an interesting resemblance was at what point in time historically they were packaged together. And they really, it's a little more than just the actual resemblance. It's a question of the possibility of getting mixed up. And will I get mixed up with the product themselves? Will I get mixed up with the byproduct and mixing them up? So it's very, very interesting because I don't think anyone's going to mix up a peanut with other things. So why do we have a lot of interesting ambitions? We have all these different things of corn.
Use peanut oil.
So peanut oil. So a lot of the. So it's a lot of the question. Right. So right. We've gotten further. Right. But we have kosher Pesach bread, and we don't use peanut oil. So I don't know. It's the interesting evolution and things have gone. Because we have the ability to make, create types of interesting things we never could before. Right? Right? You have products in your store that 30 years ago you would have said is chametz.
Yep.
And now it's kosher Pesach. Yep. Right? Kosher Pesach everything. But oils that we used to use, we no longer use because we've gotten firmer. So what is the nature of the firm in a legitimate way? So part of the legitimate idea is the concern that if I use type A and I may come to use the real chametz product, that it could be easily interchanged. You're going to tell me if that's the case, then potato starch should have been a problem, so we shouldn't eat any potatoes? And the answer is, Pleiser would have starved. They had nothing to eat in Europe. Right?
Well, meat and potatoes.
That was it. That was it. When there was a potato famine, that was really, a famine, shuto kamashmo, that really was a famine. That really was a time when people had simply nothing to eat. And they had people had nothing to eat. So as a result of that, that was never included in the Gzeira. I have a great Chacham Tzvi that was quoted to me by Rav Tellner that I have to share with you. It's a great Chacham Tzvi. So the learned people, maybe you'll learn something new. So in the city of Amsterdam, the Chacham Tzvi was the Rav in Amsterdam. This is going back, talking about the late 1600s, early 1700s. And there was a discussion as to whether the city of Amsterdam should adopt the minog of the Ashkenazim or the Sephardim. Should they adopt this prohibition to eat kidney oats or not? It was really unclear what the character of the city was, what tradition it should fall under. So when one makes, let me digress for a moment. When one makes matzah, so we know the matzah has to be made within how much time frame? With 18 minutes. Why can't it be made with 18 minutes? Because of the concern that it may, of course, be, if it goes too long, it is leavened, it has gotten a certain process as Aaron described, it's going to become chametz. How many people here keep gebrukst, don't eat gebrukst? Any non-gebruksters? Ribari. So what is that? So let's translate that. What does that mean? So there are individuals who are very loath to dip any type of their matzah into their soups. The classic matzah bride that is the staple for many people, it's obviously not a staple in the Wiesen household. Why is that a prohibition? Why would I be worried? So the concern is, well, maybe I didn't really bake the matzah properly. If I didn't do the making matzah properly, and I put the matzah in some type of liquid sense, it may come, I may further the process that had not happened previously, and therefore, that's going to be problematic. Okay. Says the Chacham Tzvi the following. Says the Chacham Tzvi, look, I'm not sure whether or not we're Ashkenazim or Sephardim, but I know that the matzah made in my community is really, I don't like the way it's made. I think it's made very poorly. And I'm really concerned that a lot of it is chametz. If I'm going to Aser Kitnios, people are going to eat a lot more matzah. And if they're eating a lot more matzah, they're going to probably, they may come to eat chametz, which is an Isser Doraisa. So he says, you know what? We're not going to eat. We're going to be Sephardim. We're going to let them eat Kitnios. Better they should eat more Kitnios, which is only, again, a gzeira, than eat more matzah, which I think is really bad. If their matzah is really poor, maybe really be chametz. So they shouldn't eat wild. That comes to me. Wild, that comes to me.
But they were able to eat a little bit of the matzah?
That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, so manavshah. So that's a classic example. Well, if it was really chametz, then he should have banned all matzah. So I don't think he was that worried. I just think he thought there was a concern. It was a chashash, and therefore the increase in eating of matzah could inevitably lead to an eating of chametz, and therefore he felt that was the safer way to go. I don't know. I didn't write the Chacham Tzvi, he wrote it, so I don't know. That's what he suggested. What about medications? Do we have to be concerned, based on our criteria, do we have to be concerned that a medicine is chametz or not chametz? So, what do I have to worry about?
So, actually, I've often wondered about that.
Okay.
Because I don't think that any of the medication, it could be considered derech achila.
So it's not derech achila. That's your claim. Anyone want to agree with Aaron? Well, that's a reasonable assumption.
Mm-hmm. What are you getting into issues of achshavei?
Okay. And then with that medicine, vitamins, what I'm thinking, what I'm eating, do I like the way it tastes, don't like the way it tastes, where are we going to go with that? How far should we go?
Are they in a capsule or not?
Are they in a capsule? Are they a gelatin capsule and kosher? Mm-hmm. What are we doing with that? What do you think? So Aaron, you're going to paskin?
It's
not achila.
I don't think it's achila, and you know, but I would restrict it to only things that are, you know, required,
really?
that are required.
Okay. Is that the reasonable position? So Aaron and Gedaliah Dov Schwartz agree, which is a good reasonable position. Gedaliah Dov Schwartz is the Rav in Chicago, very prominent Rav in Chicago. He is the Rosh Bezdin of the CRC. He's actually the Rosh Bezdin of many other Bezdin of America. And he is definitely Yesha Milismo. So if you go on to the CRC website, or you choose to publish all 90 pages of their booklet, you will see he says very clearly that he feels medicines are not an issue whatsoever. You don't have to worry about them being chametz or kidneys. If it really is medicinal, something you need. If it's more of a vitamin, or if it's something that you don't need as quickly, of course you'd rather prefer you get a non-chametz product. But he says there's yesha milismoch, as he said, there's a upon who to rely, to say that it's really not an issue at all, which is very interesting.
Now, what if it's liquid medicine?
If it's to your health.
Okay.
So again, it is interesting. At what point
this is liquid in flavor? Okay. You can run
right.
Let me take it one step further. What if it's something that's not normally considered medicine, but your doctor says you should take it?
So it
helps you.
Right. So that gets a little more
and
complex.
It's actually essential.
You're correct. That can get a little more complex, and it also is a question of to what degree. Mm-hmm. How essential is not essential, life-threatening, not life-threatening, we get to a lot of different things. If for some reason you have a unique medical condition that requires you to eat, you know, look, the same thing is true in a global sense. If I have a unique medical condition that requires me to eat non-kosher, what does that mean? So a lot of these things, then we really have to get gradations depending on what the level of severity it is. And that really requires a local Orthodox rabbi, not just this local Orthodox rabbi, a local Orthodox rabbi to really discuss that together to figure it out accordingly. Going back to our discussion of cleaning up the chametz, so where do I have to check? What items do I have to check? What requirements do I have? What areas in my home?
Anywhere that potentially had food at some point.
Right. So anything that's likely...
And if you have two-year-olds, yeah.
Right. So as referring back to our earlier comment, clearly those of us who are blessed with younger children, that's basically anywhere. Other than that, it's really an assumption anywhere I could likely to have chametz. Or grandchildren, right.
Those I who found are... under the bed the candy.
It is amazing. The last few years... The last few years, our bedikas have always found something. I've really taken my bedikas chametz much more seriously now than in the past. Even though my kids have gotten older, inevitably we do find something that was stashed away. One of my children likes hiding his candy, and inevitably we wind up finding it. So any place that it was likely. What about my office? How many people have their offices? What about your office? Well, whose chametz is it? So I always love how the students always creatively think in every high school, but it's not my chametz, it's the school's. It's in my locker. Do I really, the same people who don't like learning Gemara, but when it comes to figuring out whether or not the chametz in your locker is really your locker, not really your locker, I only pay tuition, my parents pay tuition, the locker doesn't really belong to me, the locker belongs to the school. They could change my locker if they want to, it's not really my locker, it's not really my chametz. I sound like a bad comedy routine. So the truth is, if it's your chametz, it's your chametz. Right? If it's your chametz, it's your chametz. If it's in your office, if it's in your locker, any place, it's your responsibility to either remove that chametz or sell the chametz or etc. Of course, even if you're selling the chametz, it gets very interesting. In fact, if you don't mind, I'll tell you a great case involving your son, because Pinchas Migley came to me and says he wanted to sell his chametz. So when he has people who come to the office, he has candy in the office. So he can't sell the candy, because if he's selling the candy, that means we're giving away the non-Jews candy, and he's not being reimbursed. At least in the supermarket, there's a question of payment coming in, and you could say it's all part of the figuring out the mechira, is how much income is generated, how much he gets back. But here, you're just giving away his candy, right? So how do I solve Pinchas's problem of the candy in the office?
Change it for kosher Pesach candy.
Kosher Pesach candy would work. Let's say that's not happening. What are we going to do?
Put it away.
You can put it away. He does have non-Jews who work in so we're going to give it to the non-Jews. The non-Jewish people who work there are going to own the candy. If they want to give it away, that's their choice, but it's their candy. We give it away entirely. Again, one has to be very careful when we do those certain circumstances of giving things away. A story I told between Menchen Marv, I apologize if we're there to hear repetition. You have to be really clear when you give away chametz to your non-Jewish workers, wherever it is, that they really understand what you're doing. A story I've told more than once, but I apologize, but it's good, and now it'll be repeated on the tape, so it'll be for all posterity. When I was a little boy living in Brookline, New Jersey, Brookline, Massachusetts, my family was going away for Yantif. My parents, if anyone who knows my parents, are not from the big drinkers. They don't drink a lot of alcohol. So whatever alcohol they had, and my father also doesn't like selling any real chametz, and a good shot of alcohol, that's pretty much chametz. That's pretty chametz, right? You need to get rid of that or sell it or quit. My grandfather didn't want to sell it. And we had a babysitter, and elderly woman who took care of me, I was a little boy. So before we went off to New Jersey for all of Chag, for all of the Yom Tov, my parents turned to the babysitter and said, please take this home to your husband. Enjoy it. It's yours. Fine. My parents go with a clear conscience. They've gotten rid of all their chametz. Everybody's happy. They go to Elizabeth for the Yom Tov. They come back after the Yom Tov. It's the first day that my parents are going off to work. The babysitter comes to watch me, and she brings back all the alcohol. And my parents said, what's going on? And she said, my husband wanted to take it, Frank. He wanted to take it. And I said, Frank, you'd better not touch that. It's the blouse. Clearly, that message of the gift was not understood. And so that's an interesting question. So what's the follow-up question to me then? So what is the status of that alcohol? Is it chametz? Is it chametz of a Pesach? We say that chametz, we have an interesting concept, that chametz that's been owned by a Jew on Pesach, in order to prevent that, Chazal said, it should be us, you cannot derive a benefit from from the Chametz Shabbat Pesach. That's why, by the way, we might have the question is, which of the Jewish-owned supermarkets in town did or didn't sell their chametz? Because that's a classic Chametz Shabbat Pesach issue. Every year it's the same issue.
But since it was given, and there was really no need for a kinyan, so...
It was given away. The question was there a real understanding of what happened at all? Surely she didn't. I think from our part, we with Matana Gemura, there definitely was a hefker or the like. I think my parents, I've heard that story countless times. I do not recall it because I wasn't that old, as precocious as I was, a child prodigy. I really don't remember that story at all, other than hearing it from my mother. So I think they probably told her to take it home and really let your husband enjoy it this time. So that's probably what happened. But it's an interesting question, halakhically, what the status is. And again, in light of what I was discussing earlier, it's not just questioning when the supermarket has changed over. It's also a question of the distributors and everything else, which gets life very messy and complex. And that's why you should shop at Boris and you'll be fine. Right? A little plug.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Because he takes care of his things properly, except you don't cover, I don't think you have all the cereals they need. But other than that...
I don't eat cereals.
All right.
With regards to Mechira Bdika, how does the fact that you're selling it, obviously you have some Mechira Bdika, but it's sort of silly, especially if you're going away, it's like, I'm checking, but then I'm just going to leave it here because I'm right. Leaving here for the night. Right. I've heard in Eitzah before, exclude a room in your house in your Mechira, this way that room for sure will have a chiyuv bedika, and then you don't necessarily have to do...
Right. So Michael is raising the following issue. It's a very strange phenomenon. We talk about the nature that our obligation to do bedika kicks in, even though I'm leaving my house. So it's sort of a farce. It's sort of a little bit of a game. Mm-hmm. So that is an interesting balance in terms of to what degree do you create one room which you don't really sell to the non-Jew. See, I will say this in the shiur, and therefore it'll be for public record, but I can't force to do it. I really think if you're going for the whole Pesach, you should still be cleaning everything up. Because I think besides the actual halacha component, whatever the symbolism we associate with the cleaning of chametz, whatever chametz represents, whatever reason God wanted us to do this, he still wants us to do it if I'm going to Florida. He still does. We really should be doing the same. So I really think you should be doing everything. That's not halachic. That's really much more, that comes from more of a shtafik standpoint, from a philosophic standpoint, from a mussar standpoint. I don't think what God intended was like just leave my house a total chametz wreck and just shut it up and go off. For lack of a better word, it irks me. But I can't say halachically that it's incorrect. If the mechira works, it works. So again, so if you do the bedik in the sense that most of us do, even if we're staying home, we put the chametz in one place, we do some element of cleaning, I think that's really ideal as well. And then you can do a bedik that has more meaning, right? It also gets challenging because sometimes I'm going away, the obligation to do the bedikah kicks in the night before, if I'm going away before that, so I do a bedikah without a bracha. Again, but what does that mean if I'm not cleaned at all, so like if the whole thing is farcical? Then the question is whether I can do a bedikah when you get to your next location, and your next location if you're there, and you can do a bedikah, then of course at least the bedikah will be meaningful regardless of whether you've left your house. Okay. We do say, obviously, in light of this concept, if we do say there are all the concerns that we have in terms of eating chametz, seeing chametz, and like, this is why we have all our Pesach utensils. Some people are brought to the Pesach kitchen, all the various things, because of this concern that I can't eat the chametz at all, right? I can't even eat the chametz of a mashu, even a small amount of chametz is prohibited, and therefore I cannot use the utensils I use round unless I have either koshered them, if I have changed them, transformed them, something in some manner that allows me to use my ovens and the like. Okay, so I'm just going to give an overview, and then I'm going to suggest people, if you want to go item by item, we can take a look at the guide itself. You should do so accordingly. There's a print.
How do you come to some agreement between what Rabbi Goldberg said that basically it's not spring cleaning?
I think
it takes a day versus you have 2-year-olds that have food.
Yeah, I think Rabbi Goldberg was making. I love Rabbi Goldberg. I think he was making an observation. I don't think he meant literally. I think his point is that I think he's trying to counterbalance an obsessiveness about it as opposed to a healthy response. Look, those of us who are blessed with small children, if you're blessed with a small child in a large house, it's a lot of work to clean it properly, of course. On the other hand, there are times when if you're taking apart your box springs of your bed, I don't think you got any chametz there. I mean, that's very talented if you got chametz there, right? Some things are really beyond. So that's what he's really referring to.
It's nice thick.
Kenzai, Kenzai. You know, everyone has to know their own culinary habits. If you're eating midnight snacks in your bed, some families don't let food go up to the second floor. But if that's working in your house, then
that's his house. No food upstairs. At least it's a rule. And then we have find the candies again.
All right. So the rules, the exceptions to the rules. Who knows? I think that's what Rabbi Goldberg's really getting to. He's getting to that balance. Again, it's the same thing, I think, of the Night of the Deacon itself. The Night of the Deacon itself, how long are you taking? So I'll tell you what I said, and then I'll tell you what Herzl Ginsburg shared with me, just to be sure. If you're doing the Deacon 5 minutes flat, then you're not checking, right? If you're spending 7 hours doing the Deacon the night before Pesach, then what have you been doing up till now? That's a little strange. There should be a reasonable, you know, balance in between. The same thing is true. We all know which rooms we're cleaning. We all know which rooms we clean periodically. Most of us turn over our house not the day before Pesach, but a little bit before that. So within reason, you're doing it in a piecemeal effect, and you get most things done. I think that's really what he's getting at. The people, I think he's just trying to combat that an excessive nature of really, you know, taking apart light fixtures to look inside for chametz. Like, I mean,
it's probably not Roy Lechus Kalib anymore there.
Yeah, yesh gvul, there are boundaries. But again, it's not saying you shouldn't check carefully. Sometimes, you know, every community has to deal with it. Sometimes we're too lax. Like the idea of the candy and the food, how many people check their pockets? You should check your pockets. How many of us, while we're rushing, that healthy protein bar, not candy bar, God forbid, the healthy protein bar gets stuck into our pocket, right? Well, that's in your pocket when you clean your car. Mm-hmm. You know, you should clean the car well. Sometimes people like having their children learn how to do it, which is great, but then I always go to the car wash because the thoroughness of that checking, you know, again, that's an interesting question. And yes, you will discover in the pockets of your minivan a lot of interesting things if you don't check. So there's a balance there. There really is a balance. The general principle that I want to refer to, and we'll talk only very generically about the application, and then I will actually thank everyone for coming, and if you want a different type of shiur, please let me know. I really prepared something very general, and I hope everyone gained something from it. But there is a principle in halakha called kibolo kach palto. It's a great phrase. What does it mean? So, bole is to absorb, and polet is to spit out, so to speak. In the same manner which something has been absorbed, that's the manner where it has to be removed. So the general principle when it comes to kashering all year round, not just on Pesach, but Pesach is the one we get most worried about, is the nature, the manner in which the item was absorbed into the utensil. I have to use the same type of heat mechanism or similar mechanism to remove it. So that depends. Was it used in a boiling liquid? Then I do something called agala. If it was something more extreme, I need libun, which is hotter. So I need libun gummer, all these different stages. When it comes to cleaning your house, and you'll see, if one looks at the OU Passover guide, it'll do a very nice job going literally item by item on your house. And if you want a conflicting view, it generally is in agreement with the CRC. CRC 1 points or 2 points are different. It'll talk about, well, what is the nature of the absorption of given material X? How does it absorb type of chametz? Whatever that process is, I have to make sure it's cleaned and removed as well. One does have to be careful, because some of the koshering mechanisms should take place after a 24-hour of non-use, should precede it, right? And there are other things that get hot enough that that's really not really an issue. Generally, I would leave blowtorching to experts. Really, the idea of blowtorching things, which is a wonderful method of really getting things very hot, but it also is a wonderful method of like blowing up your oven. So I would really hesitate to do that. Another anecdote that I have shared with you at different times, some of the people at different times, my father-in-law is involved in marketing research, and he was once involved in a company that was looking to kosher their product. They changed their product and make it into a kosher product. And they were koshering the ovens in order to do so, but the ovens were very finely calibrated. So they had to be done with great care and concern. He's sitting at the meeting, and the CEO turns and says, "So how are they doing with the koshering of the ovens?" And the report comes, they just blew them up. They had not done it carefully. So don't do the, if you're going to go with Liban Gummer, which is the blowtorching, really be very careful about it. What's most, of course, acutely the concerns are, you know, the countertops, the ovens, of course, if you don't have a special Pesach oven, making sure the oven is koshered properly. And again, the mechanism is the same. If you have a self-cleaning oven, it's easier. If you don't have a self-cleaning oven, but what am I trying to examine? Well, how hot does my oven normally get when I heat the largest item? I clean it, I do the reverse. I reverse the process, and that's how we kosher the item. There are interesting questions, which I will try to clarify before Pesach, is the usage of a steam of steam as opposed to actually pouring water over a countertop. So I've had the discussion with Aaron, with Ari. I don't know who else we've had the discussion with. And Ari shared with me this morning that Reb Neuberger, Reb Yaakov Neuberger, he's joining the list of the course of people who are saying you can steam clean as opposed to actually pouring hot water, which is much less...
Allegedly
says, he's going to verify for me. We'll have to see if that's verified. And actually will create a lot less matter of issues. Of course...
Do you do the steamer or you do it with the iron?
Right. So he said just the steamer, not the iron itself, the steamer. The steamer.
There's a heavy-duty steamer.
Heavy-duty steamer that actually gets hot enough and the condensation to be the equivalent of whatever water was poured on, which is a novel idea. I've been asked the last few years, and it seems like more and more Rabbanim seem to be suggesting that actually is good, which is so much safer than pouring the hot water all over the place and, you know, having the towels and having your kids not too close, et cetera.
We were just ahead of our time a little bit. But I wanted to point out that some of the people kind of think it's you just pour the steam over it. The way it works is that when the steam hits your cold surface, it condenses into water, and then the next little bit of steam heats up that water so that it's considered to be iruri. So it's still a little bit of work. It's a little bit of effort to do, but it's just not...
Right. It's not just... It's not cavalierly. We do say, coming to touch with Masha, we do say we're very, very careful. There's that balance, as always, the same balance between Rabbi Goldberg, that balance between making sure I'm meticulous in halacha and not making myself crazy, making sure that I'm not doing something that's very strict. It's a hardship on the people involved in the preparation. But at the same time, if there was some way... I know my wife makes this observation to me often. She's rarely seen women who are home for Pesach entering the Pesach with a smile on their face. So we have to find, is that correct? Would you agree with that? That's a fair statement? Fair statement. So I think we have to find a way to halacha have that balance. Have that balance in terms of doing the preparation properly, halacha, doing everything, kachotasar, everything in the most exacting way possible. But also if there are areas to be properly lenient, then that's really a good thing that really allows us to enjoy the chag much more intensely. That is my shiur for the evening. I thank you all for coming. May you have a chag kosher v'sameach. May you have a wonderful Pesach. And I look forward to giving more shiurim, and perhaps we'll also advertise exactly what level we're giving in the future so people are really get a meaningful experience. But thank you so much. I thought no one was going to come, and I am honored that you all showed up. I do think positive. I'm always optimistic. See? Are we on? So thank you for a good extra. So we should end on this note. On the two notes. We've got to go into the story. So Herzl told me, Herzl Ginsburg said that River Lichtenstein, Ravon Lichtenstein, used to clean for a very long time. He didn't used to do it. He used to clean like the whole night. He used to be very, his bedikah was very intense. And if he did it, then that's definitely correct.
What was the life?
His wife was also, I guess, intense. I don't know. I didn't ask that question. What is interesting, though, is just that there's a famous story that they tell about two Rosh Hashivas in Volozhin. That's a similar story told about the two late Rosh Hashivas in Shivat HaRetzion and Gershav Avital and Lichtenstein, which is very reflective of the two different approaches to Pesach, both legitimate approach. So the story goes that if Volozhin was the first great yeshiva created in Europe, and at one point they had two Rashi yeshivas. One was the Netziv, Rav Tzolitz Yehuda Berlin, and the other one was the Beis Halevi. And the story is told of one individual in Talmud who spent the two starim, one at each of his two Rashi yeshivas houses. And the first night he went to the Beis Halevi's house. So the Beis Halevi is the patriarch of the Soloveitchik family, very known for being very careful in halacha, very exacting, very demanding, making sure everything was done properly. And he writes that Talmud writes it was the most stressful Seder of his life because they were trying to make sure they did everything right, the right shiurim, the right amounts, the right everything was very stressful. The next day he got to the Netziv, and the Netziv was much more relaxed, and the Netziv lit up a cigar. He had a great time. It was a very enjoyable Seder. It was very careful. People would say that if you went to Rav Ital Seder and Rav Lichtenstein Seder, there was a similar disparity. Rav Lichtenstein was always very careful about getting everything correct. I think it's a little bit of an exaggeration. Rav Ital, of course, was much more the grandfatherly figure just enjoying the Seder. Our task, ultimately, and this is what I conclude, is to do both. Obviously, we want to get everything done in a meticulous way, everything properly, of course, kalacha, but with the simcha and joy that the Chag really is supposed to bring us. And in that, I conclude for the second time. But I really Go up.